This is February 9th, 2014, and I'm going to read an article by the late Robert Aitken Roshi called Correcting Our Approach to Buddhism. I think it's an old article. I can't be sure. There's no date on it. I don't know where I got it, but I've had it for many years, and I find there's a lot of value in here. The title suggests that he's when he wrote this, maybe 30 years ago, I don't know, he recognized certain dangers of Zen and Buddhism coming to the West, and was warning us of some of these. A couple of the themes of it, as you'll hear, is too much intellectualizing of Zen and Buddhism, and too much clinging to foreign forms, Asian forms. We'll get into that. He's just a marvelous writer. He has a way with language that I think you'll appreciate when you hear this. And I'm going to do a lot of just straight reading of this, and with some commentary. But a lot of it just stands on its own. I really think it's just a really, really terrific article. But okay, let us not mistake the radical nature of Buddhist method. Well, first let me just say a little bit about him. He had a long period of practice in Japan. He had been interned in a war camp during World War II, and that's when he encountered writings about Zen. And then I'm reading here from his book, The Gateless Barrier, which is his commentary on the Mumonkan collection of koans. And he says here, I practiced intermittently for 12 years and diligently for another 12 before I was confirmed as ready for practice beyond mu. In other words, he had his breakthrough. Entering the first gate, it's sometimes called Kensho, possibly, after it took him 24 years, the first half intermittently, the second half more seriously, before he then went on to subsequent koans. I read that because he proves that you know, what is it, the hare and the tortoise, just persevering for years and years and years and years, if you can keep it up long enough, will pay off. And he became what I feel is a great teacher. He never moved out of his native Hawaii, so he probably didn't get as many students coming there as they would have been on the continental United States, but he's left us with some very fine books, and I'm sensing that this article that I'm reading was before he began writing books, when there was a lot more what Trungpa called spiritual materialism in the 1960s. Maybe 70s, where there's a lot of imitating of our Asian ancestors. But now I'll start. I'll let him start. Let us not mistake the radical nature of Buddhist method. It is destructive of culture and history, as some creatures die in order to bring forth their young. We cannot put Buddhism on like a new hat. It is destructive of culture and history. Only in the sense that what isn't true, what isn't useful or pertinent is what we want to not cling to, and not to carry in, especially the other cultures, to the extent that we're attached to them. Buddhism requires forgetting rather than remembering, tearing down rather than building, simplifying rather than complicating. This may sound drastic, dangerous to our conventional way of life, but our conventional way of life has dangers too, it seems. There's a words of a Chinese master, Yuan Wu, who said, if your words do not shock the masses, you are falling into the world of the mundane, something like that. Buddhism requires forgetting rather than remembering. Okay, there's a place for memorizing. Chanting is more meaningful if we have memorized the words and don't have to be reading out of a book. But Zen, the practice of Zen, is a practice of losing, of letting go, of relinquishing, in order, of course, in order to reach the essential which is not specific to any culture, any country, any tradition even. But he develops this point more himself. Of course, simplifying. Buddhism requires simplifying rather than complicating. It's all about simplifying. We learn that simplifying our life brings peace, happiness, clarity. And simplifying our life really begins with simplifying the mind. Seeing what is beyond the clutter, the noise of the mind. Getting underneath the commotion of the mind. That's simplifying it. He goes on, the structures of Buddhism, from the banal classifications taught in Western Buddhist Sunday schools, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Noble Path, and so on, to the fantastically complex subtleties of sutras, both northern and southern, all are delusion if they are merely acquired knowledge. Nothing happens to us except that we overstimulate our brains and overcrowd our memory. So it's all of that, all of this, all that doctrine, Buddhist doctrine, is delusion if they are just acquired knowledge. It's just more conceptualizing. Now, how to make them more than acquired knowledge is to have your practice of meditation, Zazen, inform whatever learning of Buddhist doctrine that you feel is helpful. Doctrine has a place. Learning doctrine, reading has a place. It can inspire us to persist, to persevere in our practice, especially when we're feeling flat, our practice is stalled. Then reading the right material, and that can include Buddhist doctrine. It doesn't have to, though. It can be any number of things that we find inspiring can really get us back to the mat, and that's what it's all about. I don't know how many people these days, compared to when he wrote this article, how many people make their reading of Zen and Buddhism a substitute for the practice of it. probably a lot of them out there who we don't know about. But it's you know, close but no cigar. It's just not anywhere near. It's a whole different realm. Reading about it and learning about it, as compared to doing it, practicing it, crossing the legs, facing oneself. He continues, probably several thousand books have been written in English on Buddhism. With all but a handful, we choke on the dust of scholarship, or we gag at the flavor of curry or takuan. If we manage to consume them, our taste is ruined for the simple fare of a sage. It is time now, not for more such books, but for a salutary helping of prunes. This phrase, our taste is ruined for the simple fare of a sage. Again, the tendency that people, many of us, used to have at least, of just thinking that everything Japanese is good, and if we can just adopt Japanese foods and vocabulary and dress and manners, that this is the way to really get into Zen. This is a delicate point. There, we are the beneficiaries of a great, great tradition, Japanese Zen, Chinese Zen, Korean Zen, not to mention just Buddhism in general, from India, Tibet. We are the beneficiaries of this tradition that has been tested through time and embodies, this tradition embodies a great deal of experience with the human mind, and we cast away Asian forms at our peril. It's a very, very sensitive thing to know what has come to us, what are cultural accretions, barnacles that serve us, no, that don't really, aren't suitable for us as Westerners or Americans, and which are. So, for example, I look around the room, I see most people sitting in robes, sitting robes. There are Zen centers, I think, that where no one sits in robes. Here, we used to require it at all sittings, and then I invited people to wear them or not. The advantage of wearing them, why I wear them even during informal sittings usually, when I'm alone here in the Zendo, is first of all their comfort, being loose and open, but also at formal sittings when we're sitting together, to be able to check our worldly clothing at the door of the Zendo, and to not have to worry about fashion, about impressing anyone. And also in wearing the same style robes, we can more easily access this mind of oneness, of uniform, one form. I think it's really can be very helpful, but it's not helpful if you are resistant to it and it becomes a problem in your mind. That's why we make it optional, except in sesshin, where it just is. There's a different level of rigor in sesshin, where it's just too important to drop all of one's worldly concerns in sesshin, and so we require robes there. But that's just one of many examples of where Roshi Kaplow and I have had to sort of find a balance with what is useful, what is conducive to practice, that is not conventional in our culture, but which we can gratefully adopt. Though the inside and the outside are the same, Keats and the sparrow were and are and will be the same. I had to look this up. It's a poem by Keats about seeing a sparrow on a limb of a tree out the window and finding that the sparrow's existence is his own. In other words, a non-separation, a sense of non-separation. We cannot experience that identity, the first step to enlightenment, unless we sit at the window like Keats with at least some of his willingness to see. The blackboard must not block our view. That dates the article, doesn't it? The blackboard. Moreover, Keats returned to his soul self after his visions, and we also are likely, if we accidentally experience a touch of identity, a touch of non-duality, to return more or less intact to our former attitudes, or else we may jump from one rut to another just as limited and maybe more freakish. So it is after experiencing the unity, the illusory nature of all separation, all divisions, self and other, us and them. It's after experiencing that we can return to the marvelous diversity of people and beings and cultures. It's only after experiencing that, and at least a strong experience of it, if not awakening to the undifferentiated aspect of our nature, it's only after experiencing that directly that we can truly appreciate differences. And I would suggest that those ignorant people all over the world who feel threatened by differences, by people of other religions or ethnic groups or races, that their problem is that they don't have the security of knowing the oneness of all beings. Buddha Shakyamuni and his successors in many different streams have taught us how to develop toward, through, and beyond enlightenment. They teach us, and they destroy their teachings in the same instruction. He goes on to elaborate. Christ said that Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. In similar circumstances, the Buddha might have said that God was made for man, not man for God. He does say in the Diamond Sutra that the Dharma is not the Dharma, and there is nothing to teach. So this is hammered away in Zen koans over and over and over again, that this what we call teaching is really a no teaching, that what we call Zen just points to the most natural, unself-conscious way of leading our lives. It's called a teaching because mainly the method it offers, but ultimately we come to see that Zen is like a clear template. You know, in art books, maybe other kinds of books, geography books, there may be these plastic pages that have certain designs on them, geographical or other artistic designs, and you lay that plastic template over the facing page, and you see that facing page in a new way. Well, Zen is like that template, but with no design on it. Really, ultimately. And so we can call it a teaching that is no teaching. When Zen Master Dogen returned from China in the 13th century, where he had come to enlightenment, and he was asked, "What did you learn while you were there?" He said that my eyes are horizontal and my nose is vertical. In the beginning of practice, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. Later, mountains are no longer mountains, rivers are no longer rivers, and then still later, with a fully mature practice, we see that mountains are mountains, rivers are rivers. And one of our own Western women said that very neatly, "A rose is a rose is a rose," Gertrude Stein. It's a lot of Zen in Western culture that is not called Zen. He mentions that in just a bit here too. So the last sentence, he does say, the Buddha that is, in the Diamond Sutra, that the Dharma is not the Dharma and there is nothing to teach. Yet even so, such is the power of words that scholars have made a philosophy of this non-philosophy, and priests have made a faith of this religion of the deepest doubt. Now here I do have to comment on this. Faith has a fundamental role in Zen practice. If nothing else, faith in the practice, the efficacy of the practice. Faith that sitting will change us. You got to have that faith. If you don't, you're not going to sit. But what he's referring to is something different. It's blind faith, which is really belief. True faith is based on experience. It's through our Zazen that we develop faith in this practice. But belief is something that we don't need if we have the practice. Research may lead us near the palace of understanding, but it is like walking around the moat and reaching the bridge drawn up as before. There's a lot, of course, there's vastly more studies on the benefits of meditation now than there were when he wrote this article. But even that, okay, good. So we see more and more confirmation of how helpful meditation is. And then he says, but research still doesn't get us to the direct experience of it. He says, Buddhism takes us where we are, that is, our home, though it may not seem so at the beginning. Our true home. With our heritage of Luther, Darwin, Marx, and Freud, the very word religion connotes the time before the intellect became master. The time before the individual emerged from the collective unconscious that was society before the Reformation. The intelligent man or woman who encounters Buddhism today does so as a fully developed, isolated brain, aware both of the loneliness of isolation and of the loss involved in a return to group identity. The intellect is not only separated from feeling, it has built its own tradition. Destruction of that tradition is too drastic a suggestion for most of us, and we regard our friends who join the Catholic Church as failures who seek only oblivion in the comforting womb of the mother. Can we wonder, find unity without sacrificing our hard-earned integrity as responsible individuals? Yeah, I guess maybe some people, when they get into Zen, worry about losing their individuality. But again, it's when we stop clinging to our self-image that we really find ourselves as individuals, where we can relax and just be authentically who and what we are, which is of course going to be different from any other person. We find our uniqueness. This is the paradox. We find our uniqueness only through awakening to our unity with all beings. We are able to realize our differentness only by discovering our sameness with all beings. He says, so we read Buddhist books, stumbling over bodhisattvas and karma. In the same van, we find all manner of people who discuss endlessly the various levels of samadhi. Public lectures reiterate compassion and wisdom, and all about us, we find the audience nodding in esoteric agreement. And he says, surely our former path of loneliness and self-reliance was better than this. And yet the old boys had something more than tricks. I think he's referring to the masters. Instinctively, we know this through twice. Here he's, I think, talking about koans. Instinctively, we know this through twice translated poetry and dialogues, hard nuts of compact words that don't make sense yet fascinate, or pure pools of words with no reference to religion that nonetheless could only spring from freedom and discipline so beautifully combined that neither shows a trace. Freedom and discipline so beautifully combined that neither shows a trace. I have a little passage here that my sister sent me, Sonia Sensei, by Ursula Le Guin. She says, for discipline is the channel in which our acts run strong and deep. Where there is no direction, the deeds of humans run shallow and wander and are wasted. Another endorsement for participating in the term intensive. Discipline is the channel in which our acts run strong and deep. So we continue, he continues, so we continue to read and to search for teachers, perhaps, if our clever minds don't convince us that, quote, each must find his own way. Another version of that that you used to hear more often was, I want to find the teacher within. This would be, yeah, we do. We all want to find the teacher within. But it was used as a rationalization for not working with a teacher. Each must find his own way. Most of the books and most of the teachers, too, seem lost in cultural details. Mining for tailings, though slag refined is only slag. Time goes by and vital questions go unanswered. Here he's warning about going it alone. Zen is a mentor-based tradition in which there are just too many mistakes you can make, too much time you can waste. If you're practicing without any access to a teacher. Then he poses the question, what indeed is right thinking? How shall we think about the end of the world? What indeed is right action? How shall we behave in a madhouse? What is meant by right meditation, the key to the whole business, yet glossed over in almost all Buddhist books in English, even those on Zen? Well, I think this I think since he wrote this, there's a lot more practical guidance that are offered in Zen books and Buddhist books. With thousands of books in the Tripitaka is the whole vast Buddhist canon of sutras, scriptures, and commentaries and other things. With thousands of books in the Tripitaka, with dozens of sects in a dozen countries, with doctrines ranging from the sublime to the asinine, it is obvious that we must boil down, select, and discard. With our background of Calvinism, psychology, and semantics, our assimilation of the selected product will make us something strange, but the world is waiting for the oddity that will unite heart and brain at last. Our trivial concern about personal reputation must go by the board. It's hard to know for sure what he means by that last sentence, our concern about personal reputation. It may be just that when he wrote this 30, 40 more years ago, to practice meditation was seen as really pretty weird and something that people... really, he saw that you were another species, practically. At the beginning, the key to our selection is the memory. We cannot grasp an outside fact unless it first resides within, perhaps in a slightly different form. I'm not sure what he means by memory, memorizing the chants, memorizing the four vows. The unification of the inner and the outer produces the third thing, the unique synthesis of foreign and domestic. Chinese Buddhism is just this, China plus Buddha. Fundamentally, it is neither Chinese nor Buddhist, just as my son is neither me nor his mother. Indeed, the Sinhalese Buddhist and the Chinese Confucianist today regard Chinese Buddhism with the same uneasiness and distrust that many parents do their peculiar offspring, thinking surely the hospital must have made a terrible mistake. We may recognize a nose or a tone of voice, but the new child is himself, flesh and blood, and we cannot predict the man he will become. The greatest mistake of missionaries, Christian, Buddhist, or Vedanta, is to carry their religion intact to the new land like a bonsai. It will die unless kept in a hothouse, but if we just plant a Buddhist seed and water it, then perhaps it will grow into something that will shade all humankind, though its shape will be different and its name may be changed. In Buddhism, there is no form to maintain, no accoutrements of vocabulary upon which to depend. The Buddha is significant as pure enlightenment. That's what the Buddha. That's what the word Buddha means, is enlightenment in very simple terms, or awakening, or the awakened one. Usually in Zen, when we use the word Buddha, we're not referring to the historical personage, but to our own Buddha nature. Our enlightened nature. So again, the Buddha is significant as pure enlightenment. The teaching, that is the Dharma, is nothing beyond what we can learn from the barking of dogs and the cawing of crows. And the brotherhood, Sangha, is the brotherhood of fleas and angels, as well as us members of the Sangha. These three elements, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, are the so-called three jewels of Buddhism, but if we regard them only as precious exterior objects, we will not find their equivalent within. The Buddha was a remarkable man, but if his life does not relate to ours, we had better find another leader. Too often, Buddhists dwell upon the folklore of his biography in such a way that the world-honored one, quote-unquote, is glorified in isolation from themselves. I don't see that happening much, at least not in these days, in this culture. But certainly it was a huge potential attachment in ancient China of making a deity out of Shakyamuni Buddha. The masters, the Zen masters, pounded away at their students to help them let go of their attachment to Buddha as the man and to really experience the Buddha of their own self. The Dharma or teaching also is found within each of us. If it were merely a structure of thought found in books, it would be no better than books anywhere, and see where they have led us. We must use books, but go deeper than books, to the source of life itself, and that source is presented in every expression of life, in the movement of grass in the wind, in the responses of animals, in the silliest talk of old women. We need only to be finely tuned, and tuning up is the process of Buddhist training at its best. That's a wonderful way of thinking of it. We're becoming attuned. We're becoming more finely tuned through Zazen, through Zen practice. Tuned so that we can come to see the Dharma in the most ordinary of circumstances. The very word Dharma is the subject of whole books, but its meaning is very easy. It simply means the way things are. This way, or way, he capitalizes it the second time, this way, or way, if you like, is the teaching of the Buddha. Another word for Dharma or way is the Tao, T-A-O. It is probably apparent that we are talking about something that does not exist. Buddhism, as it is practiced in Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Southeast Asia, Ceylon, Sri Lanka. Yeah, that's another clue that this is an old article. He's referring to what is now known as Sri Lanka as Ceylon. Southeast Asia, Ceylon, Nepal, as it was practiced not too long ago in China and Tibet. This Buddhism pays lip service to the purity of religion, but culture executes a drag. And even the most enlightened Zen masters of Japan, and there still are a few, seem sometimes to be burdened with demands for compromise. Well, this wouldn't be, if it's a problem in all those countries, it also is a potential problem in this country. We have our own cultural drag that we have to be alert to and not get drawn into. It's a very difficult thing. We when we're raised in a certain culture, then we become it. We assimilate it, and we can't so easily see the ways in which we too are threatening the purity of the Dharma. How much freight we're bringing with it. It is time again to revitalize. Buddhism has moved forward in a series of golden ages, both in the northern and in the southern schools, each time with a significant admixture of new attitudes. There are extraordinarily vast differences between Americans and Japanese, between Europeans and Vietnamese, even in this day of instant communication. The saffron robe does not belong in the West, nor does tatami. The enlightened Westerner is likely to continue wearing trousers and sitting in a chair, though he may have acquired a taste for chutney and powdered tea along the way. Yeah, this I have to take issue with this. The enlightened Westerner is likely to continue wearing trousers, okay, fair enough, and sitting in a chair. Well, there are reasons why we sit in these postures with the limbs drawn in toward the center of the body, because it makes it easier to concentrate. As anyone knows who's done both, sitting on a mat and sitting in a chair. It's a practical thing. It's not just an empty form. Westerners, too, can benefit from sitting with the legs drawn in one posture or another. I'm not talking about full lotus or even half lotus necessarily, but in some posture where the limbs are gathered in, this is going to make it easier to concentrate. And he says, enlightenment is the power of this vitalizing process. Thoreau, Plotinus, Freud, Shakespeare, name them all. The giants of Western culture must lend their blood to the essence of Shakyamuni and his successive fathers, and then something we will perhaps call Buddhism will take hold and flourish in the West. Just toying with structures of foreign words won't do it, nor will sentimentality in any form. We ourselves must change. This is, to me, one of the most fascinating things about the Dharma, is seeing it in our own native culture. Shakespeare, there is so much Dharma in Shakespeare. And then, yes, in Freud, and yes, of course, Thoreau. Pick your own. Your own people who express the Dharma. And then finally, he says, of course, the danger of all this is painfully evident in the presumptuous writings of some Westerners who glory in the lack of structure in pure Buddhism and present all sorts of evil-smelling rubbish. So I think he's referring here to those who say, oh, we don't need to, sit. That there's no place for the devotional side of Zen, the ceremonies and the chanting and so forth, rituals, bowing. Westerners who glory in the lack of structure and present all sorts of evil-smelling rubbish. We must return for a test to good taste. As the cowboys say of the knack of handling horses, either you got it or you don't got it. And then Aitken says, if you don't got it, you may fool a few people, but you don't fool the horse. And that, and that, after all, is what counts. All right, we'll stop and recite the four vows.